Welcome to the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast, where we discuss topics related to sterile and non-sterile compounding pharmacy in an effort to promote compliance and increase quality. The Pharmacy Inspection Podcast is a member of the Pharmacy Podcast Network, delivering quality and meaningful conversations and discussions about our pharmacy industry and the critical role pharmacists play in our healthcare systems. Learn more at pharmacypodcast.com. Please welcome your hosts, Brian Prince and Seth DePasquale.
Hello, pharmacy friends and colleagues, and welcome to another episode of the Pharmacy Inspection Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Today on the show, we have Melissa Stefko. Melissa is going to be doing a webinar next Friday, the 19th at 1 p.m. There's more details on the website, pharmacyinspection.com, about that. She'll be presenting on contamination control, but this week, Melissa, she will be on the podcast talking about quality assurance, quality control, a little bit of contamination control. She is the Senior Director of Quality for Wells Pharmacy Network, and she's very good at what she does. She's had the FDA at their facilities, and she's done a great job of keeping them compliant and operations running very smoothly. I've been in touch with Melissa off and on over the last year, and I have to be honest, she's been one of the people that I go to that's helped me field some questions. And even actually helped me improve my own operation. She's excellent. So Melissa, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, how you got started in quality in this whole 503B, 503A space.
Yeah, so I currently work for a company that operates a 503A and a 503B facility, and we're expanding. So I have a lot of background in microbiology, starting with contract manufacturing and working up to big pharma, and then got into the compounding industry in 2010. That was around the time that I started getting very fascinated this niche kind of existing in the industry. And since the 2012 meningitis outbreak, I've been further curious about where the industry is going and how I can kind of liaise between the regulatory bodies and compounding pharmacies to make the regulations tangible and workable for the mom and pop pharmacies, as well as the larger compounders that are out there.
Yeah, you brought up a really good point. They're also like bridging the gap between 503As, 503Bs, the small mom and pop, where, you know, maybe they're not used to all of the regulations that have come in place since 2012 at NACC. So how have you been able to like place yourself sort of in the middle as almost a conduit between worlds, and what's your experience been like with that?
So it's actually pretty simple. I kind of got into the middle of it, understanding both sides. I'm a big advocate for patient care. So I understand where the regulatory agencies are coming from, and I understand some of the scientific background that they're bringing to the table. However, I understand from a business point of view, it's not always feasible or facility specific, for example. So I'm kind of in the middle of helping liaise between those two and making it work for both sides. So the FDA, a lot of people don't understand, the FDA is actually pretty flexible when it comes to implementing their regulations. They don't tell you how to do it, or there's no right way of doing it. You have to make it work for your business, and it has to make sense. Otherwise, you might go too far, or you might go in a different direction that actually takes it to another level that would cause more harm and error than what they're anticipating of doing. So really, it's just making it work for everyone and creating relationships on both sides, and kind of dissecting where this industry is going and what both parties are really trying to achieve. Is that good?
Yeah. I think another really interesting thing that you touched upon there is that there really is no right answer. I mean, you know, if you're squirrel in the clean room or something like that. With the engineering controls, you know, that's a bit of a stretch. But outside of that, there really isn't right or wrong answers. You can justify what you're doing in it, scientifically backed approaches, then the FDA is cool. So what I've been getting a lot of questions, and this is, you know, just the reason why I've brought you aboard is that questions specifically surrounding certifications, contamination, how do I get my clean room down to a level that's going to pass my certification? So, you know, then you get into contamination control, and there's a whole bunch of things that you have to look at when we're talking about contamination control. But the main point that I've been trying to focus on, and that's, you know, individually been telling people that, look, there's many ways to dice this up. And it really is, along the lines of what you're saying, very facility specific. So, you know, why don't we dive into a little bit about contamination control, since actually we're going to be doing a webinar on that specifically. So, you know, what are some of the challenges you face with setting up a contamination control program at, say, a new and or operational facility? What roadblocks have you come across, and how have you dealt with those?
Well, the number one is always design. So a lot of compounding pharmacies are dealing with enhancing the existing layout of a facility, which is extremely difficult and can be very costly, more so than even a blank slate. So I would say definitely quality by design is a concept a lot of compounders and pharmacists run compounding facilities, they don't understand. So creating an environment that is a clean room that has a fitness level that can achieve the certifications that you're looking for is key in doing this. Some other challenges that I've seen are changing some of the mindsets of compounders. A lot of pharmacists, especially in the mom and pop arena, you know, one thing that we always hear is, well, we've always done it this way and we've never had a problem. So, and that's true, and that can be true, but that doesn't mean you won't have a problem down the road. And that doesn't mean that you actually are complying with existing regulations or regulations that are coming out. So, changing the mindsets and getting a buy-in from the critical operators is very important in setting up a new program. Another thing I can think of is a lot of people don't understand contamination in general. They think that controlling it is the only piece, when actually preventing it is the largest piece about contamination. So understanding how aseptic operations actually function and how contamination occurs, and that whole piece, that whole microbiology piece, a lot of people are missing that from their thought process in setting up these contamination programs.
So a couple of things. Let's go back to QBD, the quality by design, because you're right. I think that's something that is a little bit foreign to pharmacists, especially ones that are just coming right out of school, I would think. So explain that, maybe give a little context to what quality by design means with an example.
Okay. So, a facility that I have seen, for example, USP 800 regulations are coming out. A lot of people are slowly trying to comply with, you know, creating negative pressure clean rooms and that sort of thing. So one example is you can have an engineer design a clean room and it will be great to their specs and it will meet all of the requirements of USP 800, but it doesn't necessarily meet all the other criteria that's required in the industry. So one thing that I've seen, for example, is creating a negative pressure room, but placing the low wall air return on the complete opposite side of the room to maintain a negative pressure within that room. That's great from an engineering standpoint, but from a microbial standpoint, you're just going to be sucking in all the air from the uncontrolled area and taking it completely sweeping across your clean room, and you're just going to be contaminating that entire area. So although you've achieved one area of criteria, you haven't necessarily created a space that is going to be functional, and it's not going to be a fit clean room for sterile compounding. So these are kind of key things that people forget when it comes to designing things out and thinking about all of the quality aspects of how this facility needs to operate before placing these the engineering controls in place.
Melissa, great point. And I appreciate you bringing up this issue of low wall air returns, because there's actually a lot of moving parts and pieces when considering both the engineering controls, the workflow, and that quality by design that meshes kind of those two together. So first, let me make a clarification for the audience, which distinguishes the difference between low wall returns and low wall exhausts. Low wall returns are for 797 sterile non-hazardous rooms and means that air can be recirculated back into the air handler. Now, the low wall exhausts are for the USP 800 sterile hazardous and even non-sterile hazardous and means that air from the room gets fully exhausted out of the building. So that's the difference between the return versus the exhaust. Return, push it back in, exhaust, send it out. So my caution here is to make sure you're clear with your engineers. This is to the audience. Make sure that you're clear to your engineers and your project team when using those terminologies. Engineers are trying to achieve adequate air dispersion with the placement of the supplies in the exhaust, making sure that the room is getting swept, which is absolutely admirable and a great design to work towards. But what engineers may not know or really even pay attention to when designing the controls are sink locations, hood locations, equipment locations like autoclaves, and engineers don't necessarily understand the PPE process of donning and doffing. So to solve this and make sure that the quality by design principle is at the forefront of the process, communication between the project team and the stakeholders are really super important. Now, stakeholders are those folks that work in the compounding rooms and that have intimate working knowledge of the workflow. So getting their buy-in and their input is important when working through some of these details. And I recently experienced this firsthand when I had really a crosshatch of people, which included the contractor, the engineer, there was a compliance officer, pharmacist, and of course the lead technician was there. So interesting enough, after the tech and I walked through the PPE process and the materials transfer with everyone else there in the same room, we almost completely remapped the design, which influenced placement of the hand hygiene sink, relocated a fan filter unit in the ceiling from blowing right on top of one of the hoods, and then it also reconfigured where one of the low wall returns are. So the takeaway here, to give Melissa's original comments about quality by design, I want to give that, you know, a little more depth, is that there is a unique strategy that takes into account all the different factors of design, engineering, workflow, equipment, and of course, compliance.
Another point that you made was prevention, you know, so maybe let's talk a little bit about that, because, you know, I'm not sure how that platitude or saying goes, but an ounce of prevention, you know, definitely pays off. And in this case, it's, you know, like sort of like you said, it's probably the number one thing that we should really be focusing on, of course, you know, not allowing contamination in the clean room in the first place. So let's talk about some prevention strategies in a contamination control program.
Yeah, so the largest contamination potential that we have in a clean room is people. We're bringing it in. It's on us. It's on the materials that we're bringing in. We're introducing it to the space. The room, if designed correctly, should keep itself pretty clean with the HEPA filters and the cleaning program and that sort of thing. But we're bringing this in. So I would start by looking at every aspect of the process. So you want to start with, how are we gowning to come in? How is the gowning process? How are they donning the gowning? And is it aseptic? Could it be improved? What about your chemicals that you're bringing in to clean? Are they truly sterile? There are a lot out there that are marketing as sterile products, but when you ask for the documentation or the technical specifications, you indeed find out that it is not sterile. So you can find a lot of even 99% alcohol on the market that is saying that it's sterile, and it's coming back that it's actually not sterile. So you really have to have a program in place where you're proving that these things are accurate, that you have the documentation to back it up. You have to have a very good aseptic transfer program for bringing materials into your clean room and, you know, setting up your space so that you're not preventing any blockage in your airflow. And you can do this through smoke studies. So there's a lot of things to consider to prevent the contamination and remediate any contamination that you may potentially bring in, because it is almost virtually impossible without sterilizing something to bring it in and have there be nothing on it. So you will always see something, but it's in the fitness of the clean room that you're relying on and your cleaning process to really ensure that it's controlled.
So another few questions that I get here lately has a lot to do with environmental monitoring. And I think there's definitely in the 503A space, I think for the longest time we've been more or less trying to just get away with doing certifications every 6 months and doing viable sampling at that point. I try to express to people that, you know, there are really large shortcomings when it comes to just doing environmental monitoring every 6 months. What role does environmental monitoring actually have in a contamination control program? Like, explain that it's not just a checkbox, so to speak.
Yeah, so it can really provide real-time data for you on how you're doing, how your clean room is operating, how your technicians are operating. So it's very important, and FDA has said this many times, that they heavily rely on environmental monitoring program to determine product safety from potential contamination. So the agency has said in the past that even they would look at this first before they ever even consider looking at release testing of like sterility or endotoxins. So these are things that they really are looking at, that they are dissecting, and it's very imperative to have, so you can understand what is working in your environment. Perhaps these chemicals are no longer effective in your environment. You have a new process in place that's bringing in a certain organism that no longer is able to be killed with the current cleaning system, or perhaps you're not cleaning enough, that sort of thing. So you can't determine these things without actually having data to prove them. And the environmental monitoring program brings that comfort level to know that your products are actually sterile and being compounded in a sterile environment, and you are within a state of control, and there isn't any issue to worry about. Doing it every 6 months, you're not going to find any trends. You're not going to find you know, really what's happening during the compounding process. You're just doing the bare minimum. I always recommend to everybody, and including in my facilities, that we do it weekly. And then for 503B, certainly it's per batch and should be continuously monitored if you can afford a system like that. So really, you need to understand what the environment looks like and prove that you're really compounding an environment that is safe for the end user, because just getting certifications and just doing the environmental monitoring at the bare minimum doesn't provide you any data. And it's, you know, scientifically, as scientists, we always kind of look at three data points being kind of your minimum to look at how something is going with for validation and that sort of thing. And really 5 to 10 points are really going to provide you valuable data, which you can't get with doing every 6 months. So really you're doing the minimum, like you said, it's a checkbox, and nothing else is, you're not even doing anything with the data because you're not following up. You're not seeing how this is really progressing.
Let's talk about a facility that doesn't really have any kind of formal contamination control program. Where would Melissa Stefko start with that? You come in and where do you start? What's the first step?
Well, the first step is you really need to evaluate what are you really trying to do? What are you trying to achieve? And then build out a plan about how you're going to get there. Some people still want to do the bare minimum. I don't recommend it. And I don't recommend people trying to do this on their own and learning along the way, because you will misstep. And the FDA is really focusing on this right now. So it's really a critical program that you need. You need to be sure that you're an expert in this area to set it up effectively. So, and especially with the insanitary conditions guidance that FDA is continuously revisiting and talking about and focusing on. So really each person needs to understand what really are they trying to do, and then break apart their process from start to finish. Like I said, it starts with, is your facility functioning properly? And then look at the process of how to prevent the contamination from occurring, and break that apart and really dissect it and see how you can improve it. What does it look like? It, you know, the biggest thing that I think of is looking at it like peeling an onion. So if you do one step one, what is that going to look like, and what impact does that have, and what is the risk associated with that?
Yeah, so I just actually happen to have the insanitary conditions done next to me. And it's,
of course you do.
Yeah, of course I do. And it's actually not a bad little starter template, if you will, for at least looking at this stuff and to get an idea of what the FDA is really actually looking for. And it is just a starting point. It's by no means a complete document. I mean, these are just guidances, draft guidance at that. So, you know, anybody that is, you know, wanting to see maybe a small bit of a, check out the insanitary conditions at Competent Facility draft guidance. Like I said, it's definitely not a complete document in terms of, you know, how you'd try to go about setting up a contamination control program, but you'd at least see some of the things that might be involved, what you want to look at, and things you want to, you know, point to, see, to look them again, not right on. A lot of that stuff is kind of pointed out in there. But any other pieces of advice, you know, with the spoiler, our contamination control webinar that we have going on, but any other piece of advice that you can give to somebody that, you know, they can actually walk away with something and maybe implement tomorrow at their facility, or at least give them a direction? What are your thoughts?
I would say that the biggest thing that you're going to need to do would, you just have to prove it. So just have that scientific evidence, have the justification for every step of what you're doing. This is a critical piece that FDA looks at. So when you're being inspected by in any regulatory agency, really, if you have the justification, why are you sampling these sites in your clean room? How did you choose them? Why do you have these neutralizers in your media? Why did you choose these disinfectants? How do you prove that they've worked? You have to think about all of these things, because the program isn't just cleaning. And that's what a lot of people think. And there's a big misconception there. It's not just implementing a cleaning program. It's having an entire thought process and dissecting the entire mindset of your facility as far as your sterile compounding is concerned. So it goes into, how are you setting up your home? How are you blocking first air? There's so many things involved in this, so that people really need to understand that every move you make in that clean room needs to be scientifically justified.
Awesome. Yeah, great points. So, Melissa, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate it. I'm really psyched for the webinar. Why don't you give us a little bit of a preview for the webinar? What's maybe something in store that we didn't talk about today?
Well, for the webinar, I do want to lay out for everyone an effective cleaning program, one that has been validated and one that has been accepted by the FDA. So I'm going to just lay it all out there, let everybody know, because we're all here to help each other. This will be something that everyone can bring into their facility and have it validated easily. And this can be a less expensive option for a lot of the smaller compounders that the FDA will be looking for a lot of this documentation. So I can go through my experience with FDA and tell you about exactly what they're looking for, but also help you develop your own cleaning program and how to prove it, prove the science.
Very cool. I can't wait. I haven't even seen the presentation, so I'm pretty excited. I can't wait to see it. So again, thank you so much, Melissa. I couldn't have said it better myself. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Melissa, let me echo Seth's parting comment that we really appreciate you joining us on this podcast and being an advocate for both patient care and the compounding industry. That's very admirable. Your points about quality by design, transferring contamination in and out, and even that profound statement about prevention versus control as it relates to contamination, all great stuff. Thank you for sharing it with our audience. I know you actually have a lot more to say, and so I look forward to your upcoming webinar on October 19th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. If anyone is interested in joining in on that webinar, go to pharmacyinspection.com, and the banner is actually on the homepage, and you can click through that to get more information about that. I would be remiss if I didn't also thank you, our dedicated audience, for joining us again this week for what we hope is information, good technical information, that you're able to glean some knowledge from. If you have any questions or comments about this episode, or better yet, ideas for future episodes, please let us know. Go to the website, pharmacyinspection.com, and leave us a message there. So, to all of our compounding friends and colleagues out there listening, we'll talk to you again, and remember, keep raising the bar.
The podcast you just heard was published with Anchor. Got something you want to say to the creator of this show? Send them a voice message using the Anchor app, free for iOS and Android.